Don't say.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of the Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
And a very good new year to you. This is Andrew Horowitz. You're listening to the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 194 for the beginning of 2011, our first show of 2011. I'm so glad that you're with me. I hope that you didn't miss me too much. I was gone for 2 weeks or a week and a half, and I did miss you. I got lots of things that we have on the plate, though, this year to bring to you. Great content. We have some wonderful guests, and today we're going to start off with a guest. Corey Rosenblum is going to be with us in a second. Good friend of mine, good friend of the show's, great technical analyst, and has a great new book out called The Complete Trading Course. And we're going to talk about that in detail in a moment. We're going to talk about the New York Times article by Paul Krugman, who he's really taken a swat at the state issues now that seems to be infecting one state that didn't have any problems before. My friend Dosh wrote a great article on the European situation and how it's not getting any better. We're going to talk about some of the highlights there. Food prices, the highest ever on record we're seeing right now for food prices. And in the next couple of weeks, we're going to have Jim Rogers on talking about that. Earnings are coming up very soon as well. This week coming up, we start off with earnings season. Once again, seems like it just ended just a few days ago, with Alcoa kicking it off on Monday. So we have a few things to talk about. And then when we finish that up, we're going to bring on a guest that you would ask me to bring on again. His name is W. Griffin. He is the guy that wrote that book. Yeah, that book, The Creature from Jekyll Island, all about how the Fed was started in a back room in Jekyll Island with a bunch of bankers, the Rockefellers, etc., and how it's morphed into this all-powerful, all-knowing, non-overseeable force that does everything from monetary policy to stimulus to buying trillions of dollars worth of banking debt and providing infusions for not only the U.S., but it seems international banks as well. So he's a great guy. We're going to bring him on, call him up, and we'll talk with him very shortly. But in the meantime, I have right up in front a great guy, really. And I know you really like his work. He has the website Afraid to Trade. His new book, let me give you the full title. It's called The Complete Trading Course, Price Patterns, Strategies, Setups, and Execution Tactics. Now, before I tell you anything else about this, I want to let you know something, and this is serious. Corey is my go-to guy for technical analysis. I mean, he does some great work when it comes to, as we call it, TA. And you're looking at price patterns, you're looking at moving averages, indicators, what's right, what's not, what could be, because technical analysis is a game of could-bes, what could be the next move if it does this or if it does that or if it fails this or that. So the book that he put out just out recently, and I tell you, Corey, this is you did a great job here.
Thank you, Andrew. Thank you. Appreciate that.
I mean, this is really, I know that I talked to you as you were writing this, and I know this is, this is some work that you put a lot of time into and put a lot of effort into. Let's talk about, before we get to the book for a second, I want to talk about the email that you sent me this week regarding some of the setups that are taking place, and then we'll get into how to analyze that with some of the focus of the book. But you mentioned to me that we're kind of at a precipice right now, right?
That's correct. This happens every once in a while in the year, maybe three or four times in the cycle. And what happens to be the markets, what I look at from the broader picture and the weekly reports and just in the general narrative that I create for the technical analysis that drives down to the shorter frames, I'm looking at the dollar index, crude oil, gold, S&P, and the 10-year notes. Those are the five markets I look at quite intensely, and they are all correlated. And that's what intermarket analysis really goes into, is how they relate and what to look at. And right now, we're at a point where key markets, for example, if you break them down into risk-on markets, would be gold, oil, and the S&P.
Right.
Those are ones where traders go to when they think all is well, and the economy is recovering, so those tend to go up together, at least recently. And the ones that are more risk-off would, of course, be the bond market and the dollar index. That's inverse stocks, gold, and oil, generally. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing now is that those risk markets have come into resistance. For example, the S&P at the it's a target level. Once we broke above the 61.8% Fibonacci, which is just a magic term for a key level many traders watch, the next level was 1,300. But we're there. We're just shy of that level. So we're looking at that. Gold is having trouble at the 1,400 level per ounce. And then oil, we're looking at a major level at $91.50.
Yeah, oil, I mean, oil took a major move. I mean, you know, it seems this humongous rotation in and out of things. I mean, gold and silver got whacked last week. I think gold was down 4.5% and silver was down like 9%. And that was due to primarily, supposedly, the strength in the dollar and the recovery in the U.S., which went hand in hand. But, you know, what's interesting, does it necessarily mean that the stronger dollar, though, will hurt oil? Forget gold for a second. Will it hurt oil, or will oil work with the markets and work with the demand issue that's being brought upon us again by the theory that, you know, China and emerging markets are needing immense amounts of oil?
Well, I actually look to you. I compliment you for the fundamentals. So I look to you for the fundamental analysis. So we always talk on that. But I'm just looking at the technicals. It's more objective.
Yeah.
So the technicals are going to drive that.
Right.
I did a study recently at the end of 2010 that showed that oil and the S&P were very, very tightly correlated. But actually, of all the markets had correlations, the S&P and the oil moved almost in lockstep. So my thesis with these reports, the thesis with what I'm looking at, is as go stocks, so goes oil on a global basis.
Right.
So many things are intercorrelated, interconnected at this point. And so those two, gold really does its own thing at certain points in time. The dollar has multiple influences, but the oil and the S&P tend to be moving really in lockstep. So that's a thesis that I have as we start 2011. So as one moves, so moves the other because of global influences for one.
Right. Now, the main thing that you think is that, you know, we have this resistance point, this magical line at 1,300, thereabout for the S&P 500. So if it does break above that, you think pop stops, moving up, you know, you're going to have people throwing in the towel and saying, you know what, there's just too much liquidity, or the earnings are that much better, or the recovery is good, or whatever the reason is, we're going to play the long side and get rid of these shorts, and maybe there's some stragglers out there that had some shorts way up to this level. On the other hand, you looked at a daily chart, weekly chart that I looked at, and you said that there is clearly support down to about, I guess, 1,250 is a magic number, 1,220. If it breaks 1,220, which I guess is a moving average, it could go down to its longer term 200, right?
That's exactly right. What I look at for the, what I call it, day by day, it's looking at the next likely swing, the next likely move in these markets. And right now, that's how we've done a lot of things from this. Once we got above, the key level to me for most traders was not 1,300. It was that big level at about the 1,200, 1,230. And once we broke above that, we go to the next level. So that's how we're looking now. We're just playing that same little short-term game. If we're above 1,300, then it becomes a key breakout above this level. And from that point, we target 1,450, which is a prior high, going back, I believe, to 2008. So that's how we play it. Once we move to above one level, to the next level, and that game just goes on here. So at this point in time, as we speak now in January, it's 1,300. And for oil, 91.50. And the targets, if we go above those levels, simply 1,450 on the S&P. And for oil, it's actually $105.
1,415 or 1,450?
1,450.
Wow.
So that's the next level. Once we get above that key 1,220, 1,230, that was our 61% major Fibonacci level. I think that was much more important than the, we're talking here at 1,300.
Right.
I think a lot of people capitulated. That was the end of the year. We had money managers underperforming, so they had to really almost, I say the word panic into the market into the close of 2010. Once that has transpired, the market had its enormous move up in early January, the 3rd. So those forces are still taking place, and it's possible just the liquidity, this QE2 easing, tax cuts, all this, lots of bullish, and as you mentioned on the fundamental point, these companies are increasing their earnings, and we're having the analyst expectations raised. So it really is a bullish environment. So I guess if I can make a quick talking point, if we go above 1,300, which is your technical only, nothing special about it, then it's looking to go next level 1,450. goodness, 10% or much higher. 15% actually.
You know, I got to tell you something, buddy. I read a good, you know, I skimmed through a lot because I read it before. You gave me a chunk of the book before, right? And, you know, then I went through key parts of this, and I just skipped over the acknowledgments. I didn't even think to look there. But there I am, right in the beginning.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, you're one of my large influence. Yeah, thank you. You're a big influence on me. Seriously, definitely.
Wow, that's cool. I'm seriously, I'm moved. I mean, that's wow. That's
well,
nice.
Thank you.
That's very nice.
Thank you.
Now, you could have put me before your parents, though, couldn't you have? I mean, if you were really moved, you could have put me before your parents, no?
I did. I knew they would. I knew them when I did it on the basis. They wouldn't like that.
Listen. So let's talk about the book for a second, because this is great, and it's available at Amazon. I put a link on our website where you can get this. But you know, you start out with a chapter, which I think is for my knowledge of who you are and what you believe in terms of the way that you analyze markets. I think it could have started no better, because it started with the supremacy of the trade and that of the trend. And the trend is your friend, we could say, or we could say that, you know, look at the trend, don't fight it, unless there's a really, really good reason to. But, you know, the trend is where you really want to play the investing game, right?
That's exactly right. I think one of the key levels, the key underscoring points of 2009, 10, and maybe as you go into 11 here, there were so many reasons that the market needed to come down or resistance, et cetera, but just looking at simple. And the book really is a call to simple analytical methods versus complex.
Mm-hmm.
And the moving averages were positive. The price was making higher highs, higher lows. That's Dow theory. That goes like 100 years to the foundations of technical analysis. Watch the trend. And the key word we use is the trend has greater odds of continuity than of reversal. And that's what's kept us to this point as we speak today.
Right. And you talk about candlestick charting, which a lot of people think is kind of voodoo, but there's some good discussions about the price alternation principles. You talk about things like following the life cycle of a price move, like, you know, from a accumulation phase through a realization and distribution phase. And what's really great is you did a lot of charting here, so that see when I look at technical analysis and books about technical analysis or articles about technical analysis, I think it's obviously extremely important to have a picture there with it, so you can see the picture that's being drawn by the words and then the picture that was actually drawn by what the stock chart did. And that's what you use throughout here, even in when you're talking about Elliott waves, which a lot of people are very interested in. You know, what is that 5-point and sub-point Elliott wave theory on, you know, you have it on page 183 about RIM, and you have, you know, discussion about edge expectancy and execution on 215, where you talk about, you know, how conservative and aggressive traders approach a retracement trade. You know, Fibonacci retracement trade. You know, the aggressive traders are going to go probably off of a bounce, a low bounce, where a conservative trader is going to go if it breaks through a point.
Exactly.
You know, so that's great stuff. Really good stuff. I really encourage everybody to check this out, the complete trading course, Price Patterns, Strategy Setups, and Execution Tactics by Corey Rosenblum. It's available the Amazon, and I think you have it in Kindle version 2. So that's available, and you can probably buy it on iBooks and all sorts of places. But you know, as a New Year's resolution, if you're looking to become really much better at technical and charting and understanding what's going on with cradle setups and Fibonacci's and all the things that we talk about here with, you know, we talk about 20 days, EMAs, SMAs, this is the kind of thing that you want to get for yourself. I really encourage you for the new year. And we're going to try to bring you those kind of things throughout the year. You know, my book that I wrote, the recent one, the Winning Investor, it has 25 pages on technical analysis. It talks about what it is and some basic issues, and I always say that you want to make sure to get the detail if you want to understand more, and this is the place to do it. So, Corey, great job on this book, buddy.
Thank you, Andrew.
Well, thanks so much for that. I appreciate that. So we'll see you soon. All right, so I talked about that we want to get involved in this discussion about what Paul Krugman for the New York Times is talking about. Now, remember something that, you know, there has been this discussion over time that the states are really in a lot of trouble, you know, between the pension plan, the plans they had for some time that were underfunded, but more so that the ability for them to collect money in a time where housing prices have gone down and the budgets have really been swelling and income has been dropping is a dramatic problem. Just look at California, New York, and a variety of other states around the country. Well, one of the standouts that has been there for a long time has been Texas. A lot of discussion why that is, of course, from the Republicans. They're crowing all about the fact that, well, it's a Republican state. You know, but let's just look at the fact that it's also a very oil-rich, commodity-rich state. Well, they were in a surplus for a long time, and now Paul Krugman is showing that they even have a budget deficit. amounting to somewhere about $28 billion over the next couple of years that's going to amass. And what does that really say for the rest of the country that had had problems, but had had deficit issues, and now we're seeing even the strongest of the strong have a big problem? So the good news is that municipalities are able to keep on refinancing and floating debt at much lower costs than they had before. But the question still remains on a state level, you know, where are the new revenues going to come from? And what is that going to mean for municipal bond downgrades over time? Take a look at some of the municipal bond, you know, ETFs, and look at them for possible shorting opportunities, because that may be something to look into. They've dropped about 4 or 5% on the upswing of the long rate over the last month or so. But this is something we need to pay attention to, as we did 2 years ago, because we're coming full circle now with deficit issues. And the federal government, while they are able to come up with billions and billions of dollars from out of a hat at all times, seemingly, you really have to question, are they going to be desirous, and is it going to be politically palatable for them to actually go out and provide additional monies to the states? I don't know. Where are the states going to get the money from, especially those states? Look at Florida. Florida doesn't have a state sales tax. Where are they going to get their money from? Are they going to raise the property tax again? I mean, you know, my property has gone down over the last few years, just like yours has, right? But the property tax, the millage rate, has gone up to equal the amount they had to keep up with their budget. Now, that's important. We need the garbage picked up. We need the sidewalks done, the streets done. We need the water utilities, all that good stuff. We need the continuation of all the landscaping, whatever else is out there, snow removal or salting the roads, whatever it is. But here's the problem. There's just so much that a dollar can be stretched. So Paul Krugman goes into that. I put a link on the website. I thought that was really neat, a really good discussion. Now, my friend Das, who from Down Under, wrote a great piece. Again, he continually writes some unbelievable and does some unbelievable work in analysis of Europe and that whole area. And he knows that I like it, so he sends it to me, because I think that the European situation is very, very dire. Taking out, of course, Germany, because Germany looks generally good. Although, I tell you something, last week, Germany had a reduction in their overall productivity and production numbers, which was kind of interesting. I think they're starting to see a little bit of the situation that we've been talking about starting to creep into their economy as well. Now, he wrote a piece for recently that is entitled The European Debt Spiral. I just want to kind of talk to you about some of the things that he talked about. I'm going to read you the first opening paragraph because I want to give you a feel for this. He said, in early 2010, drawing on the military leadership of President George W. Bush, European leaders declared the economic equivalent of mission accomplished, a bailout, support package of a euro 750 billion had shocked and awed speculators into submission. Like the Bush pre-announcement, the European prognosis provided premature. The return of European sovereign debt problems in late 2010 culminated in the bailout of Ireland, highlighted the deep-seated and perhaps intractable problems of some of the over-indebted European nations. Now, he goes into talking about the pigs and what's happening there. He also talks about, you know, that the ECB purchased debt issues in Europe, Ireland, Portugal, and, you know, they said, hey, everything is great. Talked about and showed a nice table about the number of deposits in Greece, Ireland, Portugal, and Spain, and that the percent of gross domestic product in terms of euros is startling when it comes to Greece and Ireland and the problems they have there. Probably the worst problem right now and the worst focal point, or the most important focal point, is Ireland at this point, and Portugal, he talks about. And he continues on with this discussion that he talks about, that German Chancellor Angela Merkel raised the prospect of bondholders being forced to share in losses and debt restructuring, and the markets freaked out. Remember that? And then everybody says, oh, maybe that won't be the case, you know. But now that's a hint that Germany is not going to be constantly providing all sorts of money indiscriminately, that they are going to do what they can to support the euro, clearly, and the eurozone. But what's going to happen when it comes to further bailouts, especially bailouts that they never think they're going to get their money back? So he talks about this whole issue. Then he gets into a really great discussion about the communicable disease. In other words, that, you know, this thing is spreading and contagion is going through different channels, rising cost of borrowing. Right now, Portugal is going to be borrowing about 6.6. We think it's coming in about 7%+, the highest yield in history on Portuguese debt. That's going to be next week, another big piece out there, or that happened this week. And then Irish is next week, actually, that they're going to come to the market for the first time since they had that disastrous market offering a few weeks ago. So, you know, he goes this great piece on here, and I don't know, you know, he'll publish this, and I think I'm trying to look where he has here. He has, of course, the book, The Traders, Guns, and Money. I'm not sure where he's going to publish this. It's probably, I would just look him up, Sajid Das. He's been on. Well, do a search of our site, The Disciplined Investor. You'll find all sorts of things. But I want to give you the upside, the end product here. He said that the end game is that the announcement of the bailout package back in 2010 and the events since then have been reminiscent of 2008. Then the optimism followed bailouts of Bear Stearns and other troubled American banks pronounced premature. The promise of China to purchase Portuguese bonds is similar to the ill-fated investment of Asia and Middle Eastern sovereign wealth funds of U.S. and European banks. Eventually, with each successive rescue and reemergence of problems, the capacity will and further diminish. So he goes into this, and clearly Das is on the same page as I am. I'm both sitting on the same page where we think that Europe is well, you know, in pretty bad shape. And we are actually short Europe through an ETF, and you can look at several of those. The one we have for our clients is EPV. It's a double inverse, and you get participation from the euro as well as the European markets. But be careful. It is one of those two times inverse. You got to be very, very careful of those because they have some crazy ways of calculating over time. Finally, I want to talk about two things. We have earnings coming up next week. Alcoa starts the week off. We got JP Morgan. It's going to shape much of the next quarter because we've seen a lot of optimism going into Alcoa's earnings in past and just kind of fell down on their face every single time. And then now it's happening once again. We'll see if Alcoa, who just announced opening of a new smelting or a reopening of smelting plant and increasing their production is actually going to have some good earnings and meet expectations. Finally, $8.98. You know what that is? $8.98. As Johnny Carson would say, $8.98. What is that? Well, that's the winning investor. That's the price on Amazon.com for my latest book. A lot of people asked me to write a book that had more of a backdrop, a easier to understand, well, the process of how to invest, what to look for, what are all the economic jargon that we talk about, what is technical analysis, fundamental analysis, where do you get the information from? Should I be looking at unemployment? Should I be looking at manufacturing? You know, what is it that I really should be looking at? Well, this book, The Winning Investor, for $9 over at Amazon, on Kindle, etc., at the iBookstore, all over the place, in your local bookstore. This is what you had asked me to do. So I did it, and I really ask you to do me a favor. Run it up the charts if you can. Go pick up a copy for under $9. It's ridiculous. I don't know how long Amazon's going to keep this price, but for that amount of money, you can't go wrong, right? I mean, worst comes to worst, you use it as kindling in a fireplace, I guess. But no, don't do that. But, you know, check it out. Just go to Amazon, search for my name, or search for The Winning Investor. And when we get back, we're going to bring on that gentleman, Edward Griffin, who wrote that book called The Creature from Jekyll Island. Going to be a fascinating discussion, I bet. I've had him on before, and there's always good information out of him. We'll be right back on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. All right, welcome back. And as I had promised you in the beginning of the show, we have a great guest on today, someone who you have written me about many times and have said, you know what, get him back on. It's Ed Griffin. He wrote The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve. Ed, how are you? Happy New Year.
Well, I'm very well, thank you. And thank you for the New Year greeting, and same to you.
Hey, thanks. You know, I found out some interesting things. I went on your Wikipedia page. I got to tell you something. I was totally blown away because not only do I love your book, but I found out you started as a child actor back in the 50s. I found out that, in the 40s, excuse me, you became a career producing documentaries. You have a variety of views, of course, on a variety of things. You were also, what was the thing here? It was promoted, let's see here, hosting of Noah's Ark, Skeptics. The list goes on and on of the things that you've done. It's quite amazing, your life, the things that you've done, especially the health advocacy. Very impressive.
That's what happens when you live long enough. You accomplish a few things along the way.
Wait, you're a certified financial planner too. I'm going down here. Hold on a second. It keeps going. You're a certified financial planner. Wow. About the same time I got my CFP, by the way. Uh-huh. Wow. All right. Anyway, I do encourage everybody, before we even begin, to step back out of the kind of what you think things are and what you believe things may be And I want you to consider for a moment that the Fed, or question, what is the Fed? So when we talked last time, you and I, we talked about the idea that, and I asked you this question that seems to be burning in everybody's mind is, you know, is the Fed a government, I don't know, a part of the government? Is it something that is a government institute? What is it?
Well, it's definitely not officially part of the government. It's what people like to, if they have a scholarly bent, they like to call it quasi-government. Nobody's quite sure what that means. That just means partially government. It does have some characteristics of government in that their pronouncements are enforced by law, and if you don't comply with what the Fed says, well, then you could easily wind up in prison. So in a lot of people's minds, that means government, right? But it's not quite true, because what really has happened here, Andrew, as you know, is that the Federal Reserve System is a cartel. It's a banking cartel. And it's no different than an oil cartel or a sugar cartel or something like that. It just happens to be a banking cartel. But they were shrewd enough back in 1913 to get Congress to take their cartel agreement and pass it into law. That's called the Federal Reserve Act. And that's really, when you read the Federal Reserve Act, it's nothing really different than a cartel agreement between the major banks of the United States to direct their own industry, to set their own rules, to set disciplinary actions, to set interest rates, to set up procedures for creation of money and discount rates and clearing of checks and accounts and all that sort of thing, is created by the bankers themselves. They wrote it for their benefit, and then they got these questionable intellects in Congress to pass it into law, thinking that it was somehow good for the country. Well, it's not good for the country because it was not written with that in mind. All cartels create cartel agreements for the benefit of the members of the cartel.
Right.
That's
sure,
pretty
sure.
Obvious.
Yeah,
obvious. Yeah. And so, but people can't get their minds around that because they just cannot believe that the Federal Reserve System isn't a government agency. So therein lies the basis for all the confusion.
Well, I mean, the fact of the matter is that they create money out of thin air. They make all sorts of obvious policy. They are not, there's no oversight of them technically up until recently. And why not believe that they're a branch of the government? I mean, they come on and they have more power than government in some regards. And I mean, it is quite interesting. By the way, I want to thank you for the political correctness you used when you talked about questionable intellect. I think that was a very good use of a phrase.
I have to continually tone down my vocabulary.
So let's back up to a couple of things that have happened recently. We know that the most recent and probably the most, I was flabbergasted, I'm sure you were as well, but you'll tell me, when the recent release of information about the Fed's action during the financial crisis showed that the Fed put hundreds of billions of dollars into foreign banks. Did that kind of give you a wake up to, hey, really what's going on here, and how do they have the power to do such a thing? And that really showed that they have, I mean, technically unlimited power and abilities to take any amount of money that they want from the United States and essentially do whatever they want with it?
Well, it certainly was no surprise to me, because I've known that that's what they've been doing for many, many years, all the way starting with back with World War One. That's when this whole chicanery started, you know. And it should be a wake-up call for others, though, because most people don't realize that the banking fraternity here in the United States is not necessarily what you'd call an American pie type of organization. Mm-hmm. These people may have American citizenship. There's no question about that. They reside here. They have American passports. But in their own minds, they consider themselves to be globalists. They consider themselves to be citizens of the world. And most of them are connected with multinational corporations. The banks themselves now are multinational corporations. And the world is their platform. That's their sovereignty. That's their loyalty. And so when you put your mind in that frame and look at the day-to-day economic decisions that they must make, and you realize that their concern is not necessarily America first, but the globe first and global politics and global positioning, then it should not come as a surprise if you see them taking money from the American people without their permission, without their knowledge even, and shoveling it to their fraternity members in other countries. That's just the way cartels work.
I suppose,
once you understand the mechanism, it should not come as a surprise.
I suppose then, when we think about that for a moment, the end game here, from what you're saying, I'm just taking what you're saying and trying to now create a much finer definition here, that the whole purpose here is to create wealth for the banks at any cost, utilizing the entire globe's economics, scale and power and money supply to help bankers at the end of the day. Is that pretty much what you just said?
I think that's right on target. The only way I might pick at that a little bit is to question the word wealth. There's no doubt that wealth is very much high on the list that motivates these people. But when you think about it philosophically, wealth is merely one form of power. And I think this whole system has morphed into a power structure, more now a power structure than even a wealth structure. Power comes in different forms. Money is power. Charisma is power. Military force is power. The ladies know about feminine power. Power is power, the ability to cause other people to do your bidding. That's what power is. And of course, money has always been pretty much at the top of that list of different types of power. But now, as I look at this thing unfolding in these latter days, I see that the men at all levels, whether they're in banking, whether they're in government, whether they're in the media, no matter where they are, in the educational system, it seems what they're really pushing for now is not so much the wealth, because they've already got that. They've already got that. There's no amount of money that they couldn't create out of nothing. They own the mechanism. They've bought up everything that they want. Now they want to close down all the avenues of escape. Now they want all the people of the world to be in line so that they will do their bidding with or without money. We may come to the day when money will even become a thing of the past. It won't be a question of wealth anymore, because you'll be given credits perhaps on a little card or maybe on a chip in your hand, and it'll all be an accounting procedure. There may not even be any money. It'll just be a question of rank.
Well, that's really what happens now anyway. I mean, the fact is it really money? It's just what you have and the number and the zeros after it, the available credit you have. I mean, it's essentially what we have now. But when you look at the recent uproar and, you know, the abolish the Fed uproar, Ron Paul is now in charge of oversight of the Fed. I mean, is this toothless? Is it going to be a lot of squawking and a lot of bantering back and forth that doesn't get anywhere? Is that kind of where you see this going? Or is there actually something that Ron Paul is going to be able to do? And let me just stop and say one other thing. Assuming that in the end, that what the Fed is doing is not good for the people, which we have to kind of also talk about if that's even factually true.
Well, let's start with that one. I think that if anyone is in doubt about the accuracy of that statement, then nothing else makes sense. Because then what are we worried about? Everything is fine. You know, keep moving, folks. But the fact of the matter is that the Fed has been illegally plundering the American people for decades, and that process is accelerating right now. And along with the loss of our wealth, also we see the surrender of our freedoms. Because people are giving up their personal freedoms in order to have security, in order to have food and shelter, to have their health care paid for, to have their mortgages paid for. People, it's amazing, they'll give up a lot of their freedom just for economic reasons. And that's what's happening. And if a person is not concerned about that or cannot see it, well, then everything else we're talking about just seems like a waste of time. But assuming that everybody can see that trend, then the question is, is there anything we can do about it? And your question is really good about, can Ron Paul do something about it? Well, I don't think Ron Paul alone can do anything about it. But the encouraging thing is that along with this Ron Paul phenomena is an awakening all across the country. People are supporting him. For what reason? Well, primarily, I think it's because, well, two reasons, but one of them is the Federal Reserve and the economy. The other one, of course, is his excellent stance on foreign policy.
Mm-hmm.
But right now we're talking about the other leg, which is the economic foundation of this country, which is rapidly crumbling. So he's got a lot of attention, a lot of following, and it's not that he can do anything except to perhaps help more and more of the American people become aware of what's going on. And then from that massive support, perhaps we can bring about some real political change, and we can have another Ron Paul and a Rand Paul and then a couple of more people and then 20 more people and several hundred more people, all of whom have got the picture. Now we've got something really moving.
And even we'll get maybe even get Peter, Paul, and Mary. Who knows? Everybody.
Yeah, right.
So here,
that's where we have to go.
Right, exactly. But I do want to say something. I think that when I look at the economic situation today versus 2 years ago, economic situation X deficit for a moment, just for a moment, it is much better in that corporate balance sheets have been, not all of them, but many of them have been really, really buoyed. They've really done very well by refinancing, getting rid of a lot of bad debt, making sure that their companies are very lean and mean. And generally speaking, the very loose, very, very loose Fed policy, the net, the safety net that's underneath everything right now, took about a year and a half to get companies to a point that they're back to profitability, almost to where, if not above, where they were prior to the financial crisis. Again, ex-banks, and not talking about the deficit for a second. And then on top of that, a lot of people are feeling a lot better that there is opportunity moving forward. Much of the growth has come from extraordinary measures of stimulus in a financial stimulus, as well as emerging market growth and middle class growth. And what is the end product of this, as I see it, is that the deleveraging of the corporate America, the deleveraging of the individual, the continuation of flooding the money throughout the system by either keeping rates exceptionally and enormously ridiculously low, and by the things like buying treasuries, which I have a whole issue with, is a different story. It seems like we did a transfer. We did a handoff. We went from corporate and consumer debt that we were all drowning in to government debt, and this is where the deficit comes back in now, where we shifted all the numbers over to the government. Everybody in the corporate world may be happy about that because it's no longer, on their books. They don't have to worry about it. Corporate consumers may feel a little bit better because they don't have the 18, 19, 20% credit cards or as much as they had prior. They refinance their house to a lower rate if they could, et cetera. There's some problems with housing. There's some problems with major problems with housing, major problems with the job market. But in the end, how serious is the hundreds and hundreds of billions of dollars, trillions of dollars, that now resides on the government's balance sheets, if you will, for our future? I know that was a long question, but I want to kind of set the whole thing up.
Yeah, that is a long one, and it has a lot of little subcategories within it, Andrew. I have to say that I cannot be as optimistic about some of the points that you made, or rather, I should say, not optimistic, but quite so believing. I'm not sure that the statement you made about corporate America digging its way out and having a better balance sheet and so forth is true, unless you focus only on the very large multinational corporations that are benefiting from this plunder transfer from the taxpayer through the Federal Reserve and in the form of bailouts. And in that, if you're looking at that sector, well, then yeah, it looks like those companies and those banks are doing pretty good because they're they've got their hands in our pockets. But in terms of the productive side, the real capacity of America, the middle and smaller corporations, I think they're continuing to, and businesses, even if they're not corporations, in partnerships and so forth, I don't think they're doing so hot. And I see the unemployment figures continuing to strain. I see job figures going down and so forth. But anyway, that's sort of a side issue. The real point you've made, I think, is excellent, is that we've seen this transfer of wealth, not only debt, but wealth, too, go primarily to the government. And this has been done primarily because money was created out of nothing and forced in that direction. This was not a result of a free market election on the part of buyers and manufacturers and service providers. This was done by decree. Congress passed the law. The Federal Reserve System created the money. The banks were forced to put it into circulation or to accept it. You know, Bank of America was forced to buy out Bear Stearns by order, by edict, and the money was provided by the Federal Reserve. This is a command economy that's developed here. This is not the free market. And the end of all that process is that the only reason that it seems like the economy continues to operate at all is because the government is inheriting more and more of it and taking control of more and more of it and making decisions so that you and I and the average American just don't have any choice. It kind of reminds me of the old Soviet model. If you remember back in the 50s and 60s, the Soviet Union always had these five-year plans, and no matter how bad the economy was, the official pronouncements were always excellent. Well, the economy is up this year. Yeah, five-year plan is going to be even better next year. And people simply weren't allowed to say, wait a minute, you're lying. It's not up. It's not good at all, because they wound up in the gulag. Well, I think we're rapidly approaching that point. And people like myself who say, well, wait a minute, show me those numbers. You told me that General Motors paid back its debt. You told me that some of the banks have paid back their bailout. Wait a minute, where did the money come from? You know, they're not making a profit, so how could they pay back the bailout? And we find out, oh, they got another bailout under the table in order to pay off the first bailout so they could talk publicly about how good they were doing. This is what's going on, and at least that's my appraisal of it, and I don't feel good about it. I don't think the country is going to benefit from that. It's a lot of smoke and mirrors, and people like to believe it. We want to believe it, but I just don't think it's true. And where we're headed with that is that the free market is now pretty much given way to the command economy. And economic decisions, if this trend continues, are going to be made increasingly by political decree rather than by personal choice. And this is something I don't think is good.
I got to ask you something. You know, this may sound crazy, but you know what I've noticed when you go to weddings and bar mitzvahs and various different parties and things like that? You know, from when I was a kid till now, back then, people would dance, right? You'd dance on the dance floor, do your thing. Two people would dance together. One person, you know, would dance with the other person aside from each other, whether you're dancing in a slow dance or a disco or, whatever it is. So people would dance. You know, just randomly do their thing and dance, no matter how stupid we all looked, okay? Now, today, when you go to a party, we're told how to dance. Have you had this happen to you? You go and they say, okay, we're getting into this line. Everybody follow the guy. Right? You follow what I'm saying? You got to follow the guy. You got to follow the guy. I'm like, I don't want to follow the guy. I want to dance. Well, you got to follow the guy. Everybody's following the guy. Everybody's dancing. I'm saying, wait, hold on a second. You know, I get the point of country line dancing and all that. I get that. I do. That's a whole, set amongst itself. But it's like we are mindless creatures that are doing what we are told because we are told to do it, and that's all we have to know.
Yeah.
You know, and if somebody was to dance in that dance floor without being in the dance, you'd look like an idiot. You know what I mean? It's like, wait, why is he dancing over there? He should be dancing. My hand's going up and down. We're going. So seriously, it's like kind of a very disturbing trend that people are almost, as I think you say, very much in a mechanical motion, listening to what's happening. And one of the things that has happened because the government, I agree with this totally, that the government has pushed upon the, we'll call it the recovery, which, by the way, it's not terribly bad, I think, in some regards. The question is, what's the hangover? That's the question. But look what's happened with just recently, just this week. Food prices, the food price index, is at an all-time high. Rubber last week, all-time high. Copper, all-time high. Cotton, just out of whack, just goes up through the roof. Now we're having things like coal moving higher, and that has something to do with the Australian floods, et cetera. But we have all these commodities, oil at $90.91, or somewhere in that range again, approaching the $100, and we're having the cost of our goods move higher. So there is a action-reaction happening. There is the fact that many countries around the world are concerned about inflation. Look at India and China. And what we're seeing is that there is a reaction to this. The question then, again, I ask is, what is the hangover from this? You know, how are we going to get out of it the next time? If the transfer of the credit that built up and was too much went from consumers and corporations to the government. What happens stage two, we'll call it? What's your thoughts on that?
Well, I think we have to be clear on our vocabulary. When we say that the debt went from corporations to government, what we really mean is that it went from corporations to the taxpayer.
Right.
In other words, it went to the people. And this inflation phenomenon is how that's being paid. You know, if you just keep creating money to pay your bills, if you're the government or the Federal Reserve and you need another $1 trillion, you just turn on the printing press or turn on the computer and create it digitally. And then you can write checks for it. Well, that looks good. I mean, everything's fine if you're in that side of the cycle. But
right.
If you're on the other side, if you're producing the bicycle or the shoes or providing the service and you get paid that money, and these other guys are getting lots of it brand new for nothing, and you have to work for it, and yet the supply keeps increasing, then all of a sudden prices seem to go up. But they're not really going. I mean, it just means that the dollar is going down in value because there's so much of it. So what does that mean? It means you can't afford the things you used to afford. Your standard of living starts to shrink. The quality of your food starts to go down. You can't replace your car every 3 or 4 years. Now you're driving it like I do, partly from preference. Like every 15 years, I replace a car. That's mainly because I like my cars. But anyways, a lot of people don't want to keep them that long, but they have to now because they can't afford a new car. And they can't take that nice vacation, and they're wearing clothes longer than they should. And all of these things, the standard of living starts to creep down. And that's how the average person pays for all this. So the debt was transferred, that's true. And those big corporations and the banks, look, oh, they're happy. They've got their $5 million bonuses, and they're living in the bigger house than they ever have, and driving the Jaguars and so forth, and traveling around the world in jets. Everything is fine for them. But when it comes to the little guy on the street, you know, he's paying the bill through loss of purchasing power of his hard-earned money.
So let's reel us all back into, you know, what you're really focused in on the book, the heart of The Creature from Jekyll Island, which, by the way, I'm going to tell you again, is just an unbelievably well-researched piece. And, you know, it just the details and the information and the history of it is, you know, kind of, hey, you know what? I don't know if you could say this or not, but has anybody approached you about doing a movie?
Well, yes. As a matter of fact, we've entered into an agreement with one fellow, one company in Hollywood that is
really
working on that right now. I don't know if it'll ever come to pass. It's just an option to see how it goes.
Hey, can you get me into a part, something? I don't know, whatever. I got to be the guy that's interviewing somebody.
Okay.
How's that?
How would you like to be JP Morgan?
Great. I don't think that's I don't think that's a stretch at all. Listen, so the whole idea of the Fed, I guess, you know, we have it. By the way, the Fed is not only a U.S. phenomena, right? I mean, the central banks are all over the world.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, the granddaddy of them all was the Bank of England, and the Federal Reserve was copied directly after the Bank of England. And the code name they give to that type of structure is called a central bank. It doesn't tell you very much. It's just a code name. It's central, of course, to the nation, but it's not really a bank at all. It's just it's a cartel of banks. And the cartel has been given a monopoly by the government to produce the nation's money and to issue it and charge interest on it, and that's called a central bank. And it's a pretty clever scam, actually, when you look at it historically. It's worked very well.
So tell me about the Mandrake mechanism.
Well, the Mandrake mechanism is that's the name I gave to the process by which these central banks create money out of nothing. And Mandrake, of course, is maybe your listeners don't know, but when I was a boy, there was a comic book character by the name of Mandrake the Magician, and he would create things out of nothing, materialize them out of his cape, and then he'd wave his cape, and they would disappear again. He was quite a guy, and he was always, you know, fighting crime and defending truth and justice. But anyway, he was quite a magician, and I thought, well, the way the Federal Reserve creates money out of nothing, and then with the wave of the wand or the cape, the money disappears again. That's what I should call this process. So that's just a whimsical name for it. But the Federal Reserve does, in fact, create money out of nothing, and the process is rather interesting. It's really not as complex as you might think. It's just all they do is that they allow the government to print up a little piece of paper called a bond. It's an IOU. The government says, I will pay this bond back. If you will lend me the money now, I will pay it back in 30 days or 60 days or a year or 5 years or whatever, plus interest. So it's just a bond. They print a piece of paper. It's basically an IOU. The Federal Reserve then buys the IOU with what? With what? Does it have money? No. It creates the money out of nothing to buy the bond. Another piece of paper is created, and now the federal government has this newly created money called Federal Reserve Notes.
Mm-hmm.
Now they can go out and buy things with
right.
it, and they can pay salaries. And so that's how money comes into being at the primary level. And the Federal Reserve holds the bond. And that money was created out of nothing, so that means that the money supply expands at that point by the amount of that bond. So the government really is creating its own money. It's the same as in the old days when they turned on the printing presses and printed the money. But by doing it this way, it's kind of confusing. The banks are involved. Nobody understands it. They think that somehow this is a traditional business transaction, and they don't realize that the government is literally printing money. But they've retained the Federal Reserve System to do it for them and make it look more business-like. And then, of course, for that, they pay the Federal Reserve handsomely in the form of interest and other privileges. And the real privilege that the Fed gets for this is not just the creation of the government's money. That's really not where the action is. Because, you see, the commercial banks now in this arrangement can create their own money out of nothing for their use. Let me give you an example.
Mm-hmm.
Let's suppose that the Federal Reserve creates $1 million out of nothing and goes through this motion of loaning it to the federal government.
Right.
Okay, there's $1 million of brand new money. Let's take 1,000 of that and follow it. And let's say the government gives a $1,000 check to the postal worker who delivers our mail. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the postal worker has $1,000 in his pocket that didn't exist the day before, and he takes it down the street to his local bank where he has an account,
yeah.
and he deposits it into his private checking account. Now the money is in the commercial banking system, and this is where the action heats up. If I were a banker in that bank, I could say to everybody who were my clients in the bank, I could say, hey, everybody, look at this. This guy just deposited $1,000 into our venerable bank. And we are now ready to loan money.
Mm.
And if you were to ask, you'd say, well, how much money can you loan? I would say, well, I could loan up to $9,000. And you would say, well, how can you loan up to $9,000 on that $1,000?
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, yeah, of course.
Mm-hmm.
And you would say, well, how? And I would say, don't worry about it. It's all well worked out. But
it's all on paper. It's all on paper.
It's all on paper. It's all legal. And in fact, the banks can, for every $1,000 that's created out of nothing, for the federal government, eventually it gets into the banks, the local banks, and then they can jack it up 9 more times, and now actually it's more than 9, but traditionally it's always been 9, and they can loan up to $9,000 on that nothing, and they create that out of nothing too, and they still have the first $1,000 in their account as reserves, they call it.
Right.
I mean, this is how it works.
Yep.
And so it just keeps getting jacked up, and money floods into the economy, being created out of nothing by the commercial banks.
Wow. You know, I don't know if you're aware of this, by the way. You know, if you take the word mandrake, now, first of all, when did you come up with this mandrake mechanism? It was years ago, right?
Right. Mm-hmm.
So if you take the word mandrake, it has the same amount of letters as Bernanke. I don't know if you're aware of that.
And no, I hadn't thought
of it. If you take the D and turn it around
yeah.
and kind of screw around with the letters, pretty much all the letters are there for Bernanke.
That's clever. I like that.
Yeah, if you look at that, you just change.
We'll call it the Bernanke mechanism.
Yeah, the Bernanke. I mean, it's pretty much the same thing there.
Yeah.
Let me close with this question to you. Is there anything, and this, I'm afraid this is going to be a one-word answer. Is there anything?
Can we just say no now?
Yeah, just say no, I guess. Is there anything redeeming, good, beneficial, or good that you could say about the Fed? Oh.
No.
Yeah.
Mm. No. What can you say good about legalized plunder? What can you say good about a cartel? Well, I suppose if I were a banker, I would have lots to say good about it. Yeah, if I were a politician, if I were in on it, in other words, if I were the beneficiary, of course, if I were one of the beneficiaries, either on the government side or the banking side, I'd have lots good to say about it. I'd be telling everybody how it stabilized America, how it's brought us prosperity, how it made us one of the greatest countries in the world. I would, I could write books on it
right. From
that perspective.
Right.
But from the perspective of the taxpayer and the average American, I can't think of anything good to say about it.
So you're on the team of abolish the Fed and all that, and we need to figure out something else, maybe get rid of the whole non-backed dollar, or go back to a gold standard, something of that nature. And create something more real rather than have just this kind of limitless pot of money that is utilized to prop up everything and all the rhetoric, commentary, and bashing of the markets as the Fed will do it from time to time, huh?
Yeah, there's another one-word answer, and the answer is yes.
Yeah, I hear you. All right, well, I appreciate you you stopping by. Edward Griffin, the author of The Creature from Jekyll Island and the producer of my new movie, where I'll be playing J.P. Morgan. Is here. And of course, I do encourage you, the book's available on Amazon and bookstores and all sorts of great places. You'll enjoy it. It's quite the read. Listen, we'll talk to you soon, and I wish you all the best.
All right. Thanks a lot.
All right. Thanks, buddy boy.
All right.
Bye-bye. Well, that's going to wrap it up for this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast, episode number 194. We are going to, of course, take your suggestions, anything you'd like to do in terms of asking a question or a suggestion for a podcast or praise or disgust, whatever you want. AskAndrew@thedisciplinedinvestor.com is where you can reach me, and I usually respond pretty much within 24 hours at least, or at most I should say. And I do appreciate all the commentary. Don't forget to pick up your copy of The Winning Investor. It's available at Amazon. Again, I highly encourage you to do so. And until next time, I hope you have a profitable week. Watch those earnings, watch the economics, and I'll talk to you real soon. Bye bye.
The Disciplined Investor Podcast is sponsored in part by Horowitz & Company, a registered investment advisor and money manager. The information presented in this podcast is not intended to be used as the sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should it be construed as advice designed to meet the investment needs of any particular investor. Some discussion contain forward-looking statements which are based on current expectations, and differences can be expected. The Disciplined Investor's host, Andrew Horowitz, is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor regulated by the SEC. None of the information presented should be construed as an offer to sell or buy any particular security. As always, use your best judgment when investing.